Mitzvah Tuf Yud Beis 412. Shelo likach kofer lahatzil mimaves harotzeach. That we should not take a redemption money in order to save someone who's supposed to be put to death from death, such as a murderer. Shelo nikach kofer kilomar pidyon. We should not take redemption money. Vafilu kol mamon shebaolam. Even if someone offers you trillions of dollars. Lahatzil nefesh harotzeach shelo lahargo. That in order not to administer the death penalty to someone who committed murder. Shenemar velosik chukofel nefesh rotzeach asher rosh alamos. Fine. Shorish mitzvah zo yadua. The reasoning is obvious. Sheim horshu adonei haaretz likach kofer miyad harotzeach. That if the people who are in charge of the land would be authorized to take redemption money for someone who committed murder. That means that rich people could literally get away with murder. That poor people would not be able to afford to pay this money if they committed murder to get out of the sentence. But rich people would be able to do it, so they would feel authorized and free to commit murder. That people will just commit murder freely, and the society will go to seed. There won't be a proper functioning of society. Midini amitzvah. No, so nowadays, what do we have? We have people buying the most expensive lawyers, right? Mm-hmm. In order to get off, we should make sure that the expensive lawyers are not acting inappropriately to get their clients off when they're really guilty. Medini amitzvah, amash hamer zichron. That's why in Judaism we don't have lawyers, classically. I mean, in Jewish law. There's no Jewish law lawyers. Nowadays you have an institution called the Toen Rabbani, which is an obvious copy of the secular system where you have trained lawyers representing people at Beis Din cases. So this is a big problem. This really should not be done. This Toen Rabbani is a new innovation. That's a copying of the Goyish law system and was did not exist classically in halacha. Yeah.
Are there Bati Dinim which disallow Toen Rabbani?
Yes. The RCA, the Beis Din of America.
So, excuse me, in tefillah we say there's a kategor and a sonegor.
Right.
Aren't those the lawyers and the prosecutors?
See, those are Greek words. You see, they're not Hebrew words. They're no Hebrew word for lawyer.
They're on tefillah.
Okay, so they knew.
No, but
that's not a lawyer in the classical sense.
But in the tefillah, there's the kategor and sonegor, so there's the approach that someone is supposed to be speaking for you or...
Talking about in the heavens, there are angels that argue on behalf of Klal Yisrael. And
okay. But, I mean, the concept isn't...
They don't charge, you know.
Right, they don't charge. And, so Rav Schechter once asked Rav Belsky why he allows Toanim in his Beis Din. So Rav Belsky says, if I don't allow Toanim, they're going to go somewhere else. And they're going to not receive as honest a judgment. So therefore, I allow Toanim because people are just going to go elsewhere. But the Beis Din of America still has the strength that people still go to them even if they disallow Toanim. And it's a major, major issue that they concoct all these quasi-halachic arguments. They're not really correct. And the Beis Din is not really on top of them. Then they're going to be swayed by these improper arguments. Yeah?
The Dayanim have control over who's going to speak in a Beis Din, right?
Right, the idea is that they don't allow the Toanim to speak, clients will not go to a different Beis Din.
If the clients want to get advice from somebody else, they can do all they want to, but they can't be...
Right, so that's the idea, that classically you have two untrained people, and it's up to the Dayanim. Again, you're not arguing on behalf of the people per se, but their job is to uncover the truth. They have to get a feel for who's telling... The litigants themselves are supposed to speak. So the Dayanim get a sense not only just of the halachic arguments in the case, but they can get a more subtle feel for who's telling the truth, who's not telling the truth, who seems to be honest, who seems to be less honest. So if you have the two dishonest people. They're both Tohanim, so that they're speaking for their clients. So then the Bezdin, it's harder for the Bezdin to get to the bottom of the issue and to get to the truth. Again, I'm not trying to besmirch all Tohanim here. I'm sure there are some very excellent, honest, scrupulous Tohanim. But the institution in general is a bad mark on the Bezdin system, not something that has contributed positively to Klal Yisrael.
Now, the Bezdin itself, though, could ask for expert advice, yes, if they understand that there are issues in the case that are beyond their...
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And can they bring witnesses? I mean, who
would... Yeah. Sure, yeah.
So the person themselves or the judges would...
No. The people themselves are supposed to provide their own witnesses. But, again, part of the Bezdin's job is to see, are the witnesses telling the truth? Are they not telling the truth? They're supposed to... They have to get a feel for these things. That's and the Tohanim is not a good thing. So there's a famous story Rav Shechter likes to tell that how Tohanim are very... not necessarily most attuned to the nuances. So one time... Rav Shechter sat on a Din Torah, and the Tohen was going on in this huge, fanciful halachic analysis of why his client was right. So Rav Shechter sarcastically said to the Tohen, "No, Mr. Tohen, you're a genius." So then he said the Tohen actually went around telling people that he was the best Tohen in the world because Rav Shechter called him a genius.
I'm surprised in Israel they accepted it. Usually more strict there. And they have their whole business
of Toanot. They have Toanot, yes. So then they have women who are not comfortable having a male Toan. So you have a women who are now trained in Choshen Mishpat in order to be Toanot for their clients. Yeah.
That Rabbanot accepted it if it's so flimsy? They seem to be very, very strict on Gerus and other things.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's not a halachic problem with it per se if the Bezdin still feels they can uncover the truth of the case and if each client is given, I mean, each litigant is given the opportunity to hire a proper toin. If everything's equal, so there's not a halachic problem, but it's just in general, it's not a good system. And part of the reason they do it probably is because in Israel, as opposed to in America, the Bezdin system is overseen by the secular court system, which is also obviously a huge problem. So if the secular court system sees that there's something they don't like in the Bezdin system, so they're going to start overturning the verdicts of the Bezdin. So that's also terrible. Yeah.
Well, one of the disadvantages of the towing system as opposed to the secular court is that, here, say, you cannot afford a lawyer, the court will appoint one for you. That doesn't occur. It's on it. Yeah.
Right. So if only one of the litigants can afford a towing, so neither one is allowed to have them. Basically, the principle in Bezdin, we don't actually enforce this in all its detail the way it's recorded in Shulchan Aruch anymore, but both litigants have to appear in front of the Bezdin in the same fashion. What does that mean? So we even say, let's say one of the litigants is very rich and one of the litigants is very poor. So the rich person is going to come in front of the Bezdin with very stylish, fashionable, flashy clothes that might influence the Bezdin's decision. Oh, this person looks so much better and is so much more put together, so maybe we should rule in his or her favor. So if somebody comes in front of the Bezdin like that, so the Bezdin says to the litigant, you have two choices. Either wear simpler clothes, so you look more like the person whose case you're fighting against, or you pay for him to get clothes that are as fancy as your own. So we could say the same thing. If one of the litigants cannot afford a toin and one can, so you say either you dispense with your toin or you hire a toin on behalf of the other guy, of his choice, obviously, assuming it's a similar price to the...
Could it be because one side would be considered more powerful than the other? So if they don't give towing to the weaker side...
No, everything has to be equal. Everything in Bezdin, everything has to be as equal as possible.
So let's say I'm a corporation and the other one's just a simple person.
Corporation.
The judge may feel the other person's at a disadvantage without a towing.
So corporations don't necessarily exist in halacha. There's no such real concept as a corporation. That's why we were pointing out yesterday in our shiur on Tvilas Kalim that there are those who say that if a vessel, you know, when you have purchase a vessel from a non-Jew, so you have to immerse it in the mikvah. So if the vessel was manufactured by a corporation, there are those who say that a corporation doesn't really exist in halacha. It's as if the vessel, you know, sort of appeared from thin air. So therefore, that's not a non-Jew. A corporation is not a goy. So therefore, if you purchase a vessel from a corporation, then you might not have to tovel it. And so we don't hold like this lemaisa. You do still have to tovel it, but there are those who recommend not making a bracha in such a situation. If you like order from Amazon a commercially manufactured vessel, not from a private individual, then you would not make a bracha on the tefillas kelim. So a corporation is a whole different story. So you have to understand that if you have an issue between a corporation and an individual, so there could have one person that's representing the corporation who has an interest in the case, but the corporation per se doesn't really have a status in halacha, but it could be that Batei Din nowadays have the practice that they sort of treat it as a person so that their verdicts will be upheld in secular law, which does recognize corporations. Yeah, you have to... It's a problem that ideally, of course, that the Beis Din, all the Batei Dinim would be perfectly honest and knowledgeable, and they would be the last word on everything. But unfortunately, especially it's a bigger Chil Hashem in Israel that the secular court system oversees the Batei Din. But in America, we also have a concept that the secular courts can oversee the Beis Din system. Ordinarily, they don't have the authority to do so, because before you go to a Beis Din, you sign a binding arbitration agreement, which can be enforced in court. But there are situations where a secular court can overturn the verdict of a Beis Din, even with a binding arbitration agreement, that, and one of them actually is if you don't have proper representation, even in American law, which is why the Beis Din of America does not allow tohanim, but they allow lawyers.
Really?
If you want a lawyer who's well-versed in secular law, obviously, to come represent you in the case or work with you in the case, they allow that so that their verdict shouldn't be thrown out by the secular court, but they do not allow tohanim. Which is very interesting.
Distinction? I mean, if you have a secular lawyer who's knowledgeable halacha, he's not allowed to say anything about halacha. Is that the
maybe they'd quiet him? It's a good question. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly how that would work, but yeah, they're allowed to have lawyers. And also, but in general, if the Beis Din if the secular court reviews the decision of the Beis Din and finds it to be arbitrary or irrational, then they can also overturn. The ruling of the Beis Din, which is obviously not right. If the Beis Din is ruling according to halacha and they did a good job and they were honest and they did it honestly, then really it shouldn't be overturned by the secular court. But the secular court, nevertheless, is the ultimate arbiter in the current legal system of what's considered rational. Yeah?
What about Dine Demokhus said Dine? Doesn't that justify the secular court's overturning the court?
There's a fine line between Dina de Malchusa Dina and Vos Farshtein de Goyim. What do the Goyim know? So the, but Dina de Malchusa Dina, been wanting to use that line for a while. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. So the, Dina de Malchusa Dina has actually a very limited application. It means that Jews have to observe secular law in general, but that does not mean, that refers to dealings with non-Jews or things that have, no bearing on Jewish life. So, for example, it means you have to pay taxes. There's nothing in halacha that says you're not allowed to pay taxes, and you're supposed to, the secular government is entitled to collect taxes, so you have to pay your taxes. But in dealings that are between Jews, Dina de Malchusa Dina is completely inapplicable. It's irrelevant. Dina de Malchusa Dina, Jews, but if the issue is between two Jews, so they have the obligation not to have anything to do with the secular legal system and to go only according to halacha. If only one of them is religious and is going to refuse to come to the Beis Din, so what, the religious litigant will go to a Beis Din, and the Beis Din will say, you know, you did your best. There's a problem is that a Jew is not allowed to take his court case in front of a secular court. He's only allowed to go to a Beis Din if it's a court case with another Jew. But it's a halacha, but that's the hashkafic problem that you're sort of setting the secular law over the Torah's laws. So if you go to a Beis Din and say, hey, this guy's refusing to come to the Beis Din with me. He's only going to secular law. Otherwise, if I refuse to go to him to secular court, or if I insist on coming to Beis Din, I'm going to lose all this whole case. I'm going to lose all the money involved. But the Beis Din will write up a document saying, in this particular case, we allow you to go in front of secular court because there's no other way that you're going to be able to collect the money.
In fact, do people actually do this?
Absolutely, sure, all the time. If you have two parties in a court case, and one wants to go to Beis Din, one wants to go to secular law, so the Beis Din will write a document allowing him to go to secular court because you did your best. You're clearly intending that you want the Torah rule to supersede, but you have no choice in the case. Yeah.
Do you know of any cases where a perfectly legitimate, you know, proper Beis Din decision was overturned arbitrarily by a secular court?
I can't think of any case at the top of my head, but I'm sure it has happened.
Everything has happened at the time, but it's not something which is, generally speaking, you know, I mean, there are cases I can even think of that you're hearing about where, obviously, corrupt Basedin was overturned, but, you know.
Okay, so maybe that's a good thing, I'm sure there have been cases. Yeah. I could talk to Rabbi Weissman, the director of the Basedin Network. I'm sure he has stories about it.
Excuse me, this is all civil cases, not corrupt.
I mean, Jews don't have, but the Edenim don't have the authority to try criminal cases anymore. We're only talking about civil cases, yeah. Yeah.
Well, wait, so, but let's suppose that one Jew goes and actually robs and steals from another one. According to halacha, this is a civil matter.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
But according to criminal law, you know, then of course he's going to be prosecuted and put in jail. What's the? I mean, is it not allowed? It's called to tell the police. You know.
I mean, in such a situation that someone's robbing and stealing from you, so it could be that he's going to be a danger to others. Or you could maybe find a terem to tell the police. But if it's one particular instance that a Jew stole from you and you could recover your money in Beis Din, of course there's no heter whatsoever to go to the secular authorities. But Dina de Machuza Dina has a much more limited application than people think. You follow secular law in all cases. You only follow secular law in a case where it does not conflict with halacha, and the issue is between Jews and non-Jews. Within the Jewish community, we're not supposed to pay any attention to secular law. I mean, if the secular law has a good idea, if you live in Kiryas Yoel, for example, and only Jews live there, you should still obey the speed limit, because the halacha encourages you to be safe anyway, and there's no clash with halacha at all, so you should still obey the speed limit. But that doesn't mean that if in some non-Jewish law about the way neighbors should interact, and the two people voluntarily say, you know, we want to follow the Torah's rule instead of we were going to ignore the secular law, and nobody cares, and the police don't care because you know neither of the parties care, and they're not watching closely, so of course you don't have to obey the secular law. Okay. Midini mitzvah, Ma'ashem Zichron Levracha, Shafilu Ratzo Goel Hadam Lefacho, even if the Goel Hadam wants to say, you know, I'm willing to take money not to perform my duty as the Goel Hadam. Again, if the Goel Hadam doesn't want to do that for whatever other reasons, he says, you know, I can't stomach the idea of killing, whatever it is, that's one thing. But here, if he says, you know, I'm willing, you know, let's say it was his uncle. He says, you know, I liked my uncle. You know, he was fine. He wasn't my most favorite relative. I'm going to kill the person who killed him, but you know what? For a nice, house in the Hamptons, I might be willing to reconsider. So take money. He should be killed. Nowadays, we don't do these things. So what do you mean? You're going to jump on me. I say this applies to females, but females don't judge. How could this apply to females? He says, oh, that would be shehein einan danos ve'inyan hu she'im ulai bizman ha'u. Or maybe that's an incorrect girsa, and it should really be bizman hazeh. Machmas malchus osiba acheres yavo biat isha inyan she'ishlu mena la'atzel nefesh rotzeach bishul mamon. That this applies even in secular law. If the secular authorities are going to properly punish a murderer by putting him or her to death, and it's a woman who's offering money to save the murderer, that's not allowed. Even though she can't say it's a halacha, she's not serving as a witness or a judge, there might be situations where maybe she's the Goel Hadam, whatever it is, then she would not be allowed to take money in order to let the guy off scot-free. You violated this negative commandment, and your punishment is very great. It could encourage murder and cause some Jews to lose their lives. Mitzvah Taf Yud Gimel 413. The same thing. You don't take money that's for somebody who's supposed to go to an ir miklat. Again, they killed accidentally, and the Goel Hadam could kill this person if they're not in an ir miklat. So they're still not allowed to take money for that. So the same thing. Even though he will not be subject to the death penalty in the Beis Din, maybe you'll say to the Goel Hadam, hey, I'm not really interested in going to the Irmiklut. You know, I like my house. I like my pool. You know, in the Irmiklut, I'm going to be in a small little apartment. Maybe I pay you, you know, $100,000 and you'll let me off and I can stay here and I won't have to go to Golos. Nope. You're not allowed to do that. So here it's taking the word nus as a passive participle, somebody who's subject to the running away, which is interesting, that you think that it would be an infinitive to run, but here it means you should not take a redemption money for somebody who's subject to running away to the Irmiklut. Whatever it is, we know what it means. Shorish Isser, I know in this group we don't get too worked up over grammar, right? Shorish Isser HaKofer Behorig Shogig V'cholin Yano Kinyin Horig Mezid Ein Tzorech La'arich Bo'adibor, that people have to know that if they kill, whether accidentally or on purpose, they're going to be subject to the penalty and there's no money that will enable them to get off. Oh, I should have brought in schnapps today.
What?
Maybe making a siyum. Oh. Say for Bamidbar.
No, it's all right.
Dvarim, Kasav Haramban. What, too early for you? Kasav Haramban, Zal, Zog the Ramban in his commentary to Sefer Dvarim. Inyana Sefer Azayadua. So here, he doesn't give an introduction to the mitzvah right off the bat. He gives an introduction to the sefer, which is somewhat unusual. Shehu Mishneh HaTorah, it's a repetition of the Torah. Yachzer b'Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom l'dor ha-nichnas ba'aretz rov mitzvos ha-Torah tzrichos li-Yisrael. He chazers. He's reviewing the mitzvos that they need to know before they go into Eretz Yisrael. He really drills it into them. He tells you you're going to really get punished if you don't do them. Sometimes you add a little. He adds a little bit of explanation. He doesn't really repeat the mitzvahs of the priests. That Kohanim don't need repetition. You tell them once, they got it. They're really diligent about reviewing themselves. They don't need the teacher to spoon feed them with the review. The old Yosi b'Sefer is like tzas mitzvos shelo nizkiru kal. There's some new mitzvos found in Sefer Dvarim. Kegon, hayibum, leveret marriage, which is a fun one, which we'll get to hopefully in a couple months maybe. V'din gerushin ba'isha, the possibility of getting divorced. If it weren't be for Sefer Dvarim, we wouldn't know there's a possibility to get divorced. We might have to be like Catholics, lahavdil. But we now know that there's a possibility of getting divorced. I'm sorry, I missed one. Motzi Shemra is if there's a woman who you get married, and then she's found not to be a virgin, etc. What goes on there? And they're false witnesses. So all these things are not mentioned previously in the Torah, and they're added in Sefer Devarim. They were said already before. Kadosh Baruch Hu taught them to Moshe Rabbeinu before. It's only the Tochacha that was added in to that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know before. Kasher Nisparish Bo. Not once in Sefer Devarim does it say, and the Lord spake to Moses, saying, command the children of Israel, etc. Odaber al b'nei Yisrael v'amartol liyam mitzvah plonis. Is adkan. So it doesn't tell, not the new mitzvos, are not because they're a new thing here that you didn't know before, but rather, it's just within the repetition you add stuff in. So it was one of my favorite academic divrei Torah, which supports the traditional understanding of the Torah. There's a professor named, Joshua Berman, I believe is his name, I believe from Bar-Ilan. So he has Dvar Torah and Sefer Dvarim at the Bible critics say, oh, must be that Sefer Dvarim, you know, Kav Yochel, they say it was written by a different author because it has a different style, different mitzvahs, whatever. So he says, Professor Berman says, you don't know what you're talking about. You're coming up, you're reading the Torah from the perspective of 21st century literature. or 20th century or 19th century literature. Where you have a book and it starts, you know, once upon a time, and it ends with a resolution of the plot. This is not how ancient Near Eastern literature worked. Even law codes. What the way ancient Near Eastern law codes worked is that you had the original main presentation of the legal matter, and then at the end, it was summed up again. And they added extra asharos. They said extra drilling it in towards the end, and through the in the repetition at the end, they threw in extra stuff to keep your attention during the repetition. So you had, this is exactly follows the mold of ancient Near Eastern literature and has nothing to do, chas v'shalom, with different authors. V'zeh shelo huskiru eile ha-mitzvos b'svarim ha-rishonim, as also Moshe Rabbeinu talking. Again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu put his temple on the Sefer Dvarim as well, but it's in the voice of Moshe Rabbeinu as opposed to the rest of the Chumash. V'zeh shelo huskiru eile ha-mitzvos b'svarim ha-rishonim k'moshe ha-mitzvos al tisma b'davar achar ha-am zichron al-drocha b'kama l'komos ein mukta b'mokha b'torah. That the Torah doesn't present things in exact chronological order, perhaps for the reason we just mentioned. V'shorish inyan zeh lefi adome ki haTorah tichlol kol hachochmos milvad pshat inyoneha mesukim b'yisodos mitzvoseh chazokim. So in addition to the mitzvos per se, the Torah includes all wisdom. V'afshir ki... Okay, that's Shaila, exactly. And everybody agrees with this presentation. If you could learn all wisdom simply by looking in the Torah. So we ask Rabbi Meiselman, so maybe the answer is... Maybe the answer is yes, but not everybody agrees that you can literally learn all types of wisdom from the Torah. That's why the Vilna Gaon used to study geometry and other things, because he felt that that was needed in order to understand the Torah better. In order to get a more complete picture of all the wisdom that's included in the Torah, it has to be presented in a certain order. God presented this because he felt that this would be the best way to learn it. The Zetam Maspik, that's good enough for now. Parshas Dvarim, here we go. Eila Dvarim Yeshba Shtei Mitzvahs Lo Sasei. There are two negative commandments in Parshas Dvarim. Mitzvah Tav Yudal. Shelo Limno Limanos Dayan Adam She'enu Chacham Bedinei Torah Afabishu Chacham B'Chachma Sacheros. One should not appoint a judge who is not knowledgeable about the Torah, even if he's knowledgeable in secular, or maybe he's the top mathematician in the world, or the top historian, even if he's a very smart, knowledgeable individual, nevertheless, if he's not an expert in the Torah, he may not serve as a judge. Shenimna bezdin agadol rosh golus, that whoever it is, again, the main mitzvah is on the bezdin agadol, the great Sanhedrin. But it applies even nowadays, that if there's someone in charge of the Jewish community who's appointing the judges, so you make sure to appoint only those who are most knowledgeable. Maybe the government of the state of Israel is musar in this mitzvah, that they are only allowed to appoint judges who are very knowledgeable. And they seem, actually, this is one thing that they seem to do right. That they actually pretty much do have a very high standard of dayanim in Israel, that they only appoint people who are really experts and have passed really, really tough exams.
Even the ones that go to jail, right? An instance of a chemist, a Jewish chemist, yeah, from who became big authority in kashrus, like it's around the 1920s, 1930s, like the OU had involved. Yeah, there's a thing in the Times Literary Supplement about, you know, yeah, this guy. And but the rabbis basically forced him out. And the reason was he started paskening halacha. Because, you know, and he was a big expert in chemistry, you know, but no, he could not go ahead and apply that, say, oh, you see, chemically, this is kosher, you know, like that.
Well, yeah, that's why you need both. You need the scientific experts, and you need the halachic experts. Yeah, that's why, in America, at least, you have companies that produce flavors, which requires a lot of chemistry. You need a lot of scientific knowledge, and the flavors are used by products throughout the industry. So, Baruch Hashem, we should say, that virtually every single one, maybe every single one, of these companies that produce flavors are certified either by the OU or the Chaf Kei, because they have both, they know their limitations. The rabbis who are the head of these organizations, they consult very seriously. They have chemists on staff, scientists on staff, that can really analyze how all these flavors are made with the complex chemical processes and determine reliably whether the flavors are kosher or not, and these are relied upon. This is the this is the big secret, don't tell your Chassidish friends, that even if you have a product with the fanciest Hechsherim from Williamsburg, unless they don't use any flavoring, so they all rely ultimately on the national Hashgachos to certify these products. Not really. There is a concept of batel b'shishim, but that if it's less than one in 60 of the mixture, so then it remains kosher. But the major limitation on that is that it has to fall in by accident. If you put it there on purpose, if you put it there on purpose, that it's an ingredient in this thing because you. That's why, for example, if you have milk, so you have milk, you will go to the store and the milk might say OUD on the milk. So you might think to yourself, oh, what do you mean? The OU doesn't not makbid, there should be hashkach on milk. So why does the milk need a, what does OUD on milk mean? So it means that the vitamins that they add to the milk are certified kosher. But what will they tell you? Do you go to the OU and they tell you, does milk need a hashkacha? They'll say no. So why do you have hashkacha and milk with the vitamins? The answer is that the goyim who are producing the milk are adding vitamins from a non-kosher source. You don't care. So as far as you're concerned, they're butthole. So therefore, they're less than one in whatever, it's much less than one in thousands. Of the mixture, so therefore, if you're not makbid al chal b'Yisrael, so then this milk is kosher. You're allowed to drink the milk. But if the OU, the company comes to the OU and says, "Hey OU, we know really you're not makbid al chal b'Yisrael, but we know that if something has hechsher on it, it sells better. So we want our milk to have an OU on it." So you will say, "Fine, we'll give you an OU on your milk." But if we're giving a hashgacha that we're saying this is kosher, and now the Jews are supervising the production of this milk, even if they're not watching the milking, but they have something to do with the production of this milk, so then you're not allowed to use even the tiniest amount of non-kosher substance to put it in the milk l'chatchila. But in a case, for example, where you have a product where there's a non-kosher ingredient less than 1/60th, but it's still an important, it's a part of the mixture that you care about, and it wouldn't be the same product without this, and it wouldn't taste the same maybe, and it wouldn't have the same consistency, whatever it is, without this trade product, even if it's much less than 1/60th, is not batal. Yeah.
Like rennet and cheese, for example.
Right. Rennet and cheese is because it's a davar amamid, that the cheese is only made through the intervention of the non-kosher substance. That's true. Right, but even if it's not a davar amamid, but it's something that's used as an ingredient in the thing, then it would still be a problem. So, for example,
yeah, but it's also vegetable rennet also.
Yeah,
you don't have to use. That's not problematic as much.
Right, but you still need, because of the gzera, that you need to have kosher cheese. So you still need to have a Jew either watch or produce the OU is makbil, like the shach. The famous one, machlokes between the shach and the Rama. That when it say you need to have Jewish cheese, doesn't mean the Jew needs to watch a cheese making, or the Jew needs to actually make the cheese. So the OU and most other reliable agencies are makbid that according to the sheet of the shach, that the Jew actually needs to make the cheese. In other words, the mashgiach is actually going to pour the rennet into the milk to make the cheese.
So on the basis of what
the okay, we'll talk later. That was the R Rishonim who hold that the cheese is. Whatever. It's a minority opinion, the Rishonim. It's very much rejected by Klal Yisrael for 1,000 years. Why Rav Soloveitchik decided
and
to...
And the very common so-called Hashgacha, which relies on Tosafot, something like that, which has been a sheet of
the...
Right?
The Tablet K.
Right, which says you don't need any supervision at all.
Tablet K actually is not exactly relying on that. The Tablet K, they don't accept the Shach, that the Jew needs to make the cheese. They want to go like the Ramah, who says that it's sufficient for the Jew to watch the cheese making, and they want to say even for the Rama, it's sufficient, Yotzei v'nichnas. So the Mashgiach visits the factory every once in a while, so that's sufficient. So obviously both those assumptions are very questionable. A, that we don't go like the Shach, and even if you don't want to go like the Rama, so really, Pashtus is that the Rama means that the Jew, it's not like Ramosha's Chiddush of Chol of Yisrael, whatever, but in America, that it's pashtus is that the mashgiach needs to be standing there watching the whole time if they're making the cheese, even if you want to rely on the Rama. So that's why the tablet K is not in line with the normative standards of kashrus that people do.
Even if the name of the cheese has the word kosher in it, in case. Amy's kosher cheese, something like
yeah.
that. Yeah, right.
again, if you have a neighbor who's not Frum and he says, should I buy this or should I buy totally unsupervised cheese? Okay, so take the tablet cake, but it's not for Frum people. It's a shvach hashgacha, yeah.
What does it look like?
Looks like the luchos, with the K inside.
Unfortunately, it's taking over a lot of cheese and a lot of lox. It's very frustrating.
Well, lox is less problematic. Again, I don't know why they would take the tablet K instead of the OU, which probably doesn't. I probably take more money. What?
Cheaper, but the, yeah, but
right, it would be cheaper.
I mean, lox at least.
Lox is not hard to certify.
Not hard to certify because, right? I mean, they don't smoke eels in the same. You know.
Right. You just have to, again, especially if you accept the idea that. By salmon, you don't need to see the scales of the fish because only kosher fish are that color. So not all hashgachos accept this. The Star K actually does not accept that for some reason. That they insist even for salmon that the mashgiach has to see the actual scales. So most hashgachos accept the idea that for salmon, you don't actually have to see the scales because only kosher fish are that color. So the Star K says, well, you know, if you would feed non-kosher fish... the same thing that you feed salmon that causes their flesh to turn pinkish, orangish, whatever, so that would also turn orange.
Is that true?
Okay. Maybe it's true, but lemaisa, it doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. So you don't have to be concerned for a possibility that doesn't really exist, even if it's theoretically possible. There's no fish on the market that's color. That's if the situation would change, then you would not be allowed to rely on that.
Nobody but wants as of to now, buy pink catfish. You know?
Right, but as of now, salmon and trout, certain types of trout, are the only fish that have that color, which are kosher fish. So, again, according to the most shittas, one does not have to be concerned that with any other possibility. Okay. So that's why lox, again, is probably less of a problem, but I don't know exactly why they're taking, again, because if it's just the cheapness, so... I don't know. It's hard to imagine that the OU charges that much for certifying locks if they just have to go in once in a while and check to make sure that the smoker is not used for, like you say, eels, which shouldn't be such a big job, but whatever it is. Anyway, so the idea of kashrus agencies relying on each other is indeed an issue. That's why people knock, including some people sitting at this table, people knock the Eidah Haredes Hashgacha, which is generally, in general, viewed as the best in the world. Because their policy is that they do not accept any other hashgacha. That every product with their hashgacha on it, every restaurant with their hashgacha, is only allowed to use products with their own hashgacha. And throughout every stage, from the stage where it needs hashgacha at all, until the stage where you get to the final product, they only accept things with their own hashgachas. They say, oh, it's a racket. You're making sure that people have to get more and more things, have to take your hashgacha because you won't accept any other hashgacha. But the reason is, I mean, again, that might be part of it, that they want to encourage people to take their own hashgacha. But it's, on the other hand, you won't have the issue like the Pesach vinegar issue because they won't be taking. The OU will not, in other words, the OU is
unless
taking
the
OK.
Make a mistake, you know.
That's unlikely. Again, anything's possible. Anyway, so that's there is some advantage to that... system where you only use your own hashgacha because of this issue that there could be hashgachas with different standards that they unknowingly accept a standard that would be lower than that if they would than it would be if they were supervising the product themselves. Okay, so you have to have a dayan who knows the law. You have to have learned Choshen Mishpat very well. Even if he's the nicest, sweetest person in the world. No. Only if he's an expert in Choshen Mishpat. You can't make him a judge. Literally, you shall not recognize faces. In other words, you shall not show preference or bias. It means you should not give undue preference to someone in judgment. So this is not clear from the pasuk. This is what it means, but that you shouldn't point to Dayan who's not knowledgeable. But the Sifri, the Lachik Medrash, darshins it as meaning that you should not appoint someone who is not knowledgeable. V'chein perish zichron levracha lo sakir panim b'mishpat zeh emuna lahoshiv dayonim. That somebody who is in charge of appointing the judges should not appoint someone who's not qualified. Kilomar. She'elav ba azharazo. That he's the one who's subject to this mitzvah. V'amar zichron levracha, Shema tomar yish ploni noeh. Well, this guy is so handsome. Everyone wants to. Maybe we should appoint him as a judge. The litigants, you know, are going to want to go to him because he's so good looking. That you know, why should they? The whole they have to stand looking for at this guy for hours while they argue their case. They might as well have something pleasant to lay their eyes on. Oh, Gibor, He works out at the gym. He has really big muscles. In some way, he's going to make a positive impression on the Bali Din. Oh, Usher, he's really rich. Maybe we should appoint Bill Gates. Oh, no, he's not the richest anymore. From almost all my life, but everyone wanted to use an example of a rich person, say Bill Gates, and I have to say Jeff Bezos. Not that Bill Gates is still rich.
Well, doesn't the Rambam someplace say that the judge has to be rich in order he should not be bribable?
Not that you appoint him because he's rich. If he's very knowledgeable and he's well off, so he's less likely to accept bribes, then yeah, that's good. That's a positive thing. Oh, sheyodea b'choloshon. He knows these many languages, so he'll be able to understand the Bali Dinim. Let's say he has... people come speaking Spanish and Yiddish and Hebrew and English. So he should be able to understand what they say. Oshivenu Dayan.
Wait a second. Wasn't it said that
the Sanhedrin
understood every single language in the world or something like that?
Shivim Lashon is one of the criteria. Yeah. It says even if they can't speak it, if they can get the basics of the Shivim Lashon.
Well, obviously, that sounds like it's a good thing for a Dayan to be
right,
able
it's
to
also good, right, but he also has to know the laws. Right, you're 100% right. If he knows, if he's multilingual and he knows Choshen Mishpat very well, then it's good. Again, not that this guy is malicious. Maybe he thinks, cool, I can be a judge. You know, I'm very rich. I know a lot of languages. I could be a judge, but I really think this guy is right. This litigant, I really think the plaintiff is correct, and I'm gonna give him the case. That's not good. He has to make sure that the person who's really properly should win, and halacha wins. Shorish mitzvazo nigla hu lachol. This is obvious that we don't want to pervert justice, so that's why we have to do this. Dineha, what are the halachas? Geod ma'ash amir zichron levracha kishe kishem shetzarech haroi. Lios dayan, lios yodea dinei Torah, kmo kein tzorich lios bal midos v'adam kosher. So just like the person has to know Choshen Mishpat very well, so he has to have good character traits and be a generally upstanding person. Shelo yomar lo anidon tol kora mi b'nei necha, kelomar kashet atzmacha v'achakach kishot acherim. They says the litigant should not be able to say to the dayan, or the dayan says to them, you're not behaving right. You give him back his money right away. And the litigant says, you first. Hore Omer b'Torah gabi dayonim anoshim chachomim, wise people. Omer yodei achochma aladun dinemes. They have to be able to judge properly because they know the laws. Viduim l'shivteichem, and known to your tribes. What does that mean? Elu sheruach abrios nocha mehem. That people are generally pleased with them. That they don't have grudges against them. This ends up sometimes one person ends up deciding the case anyway, because sometimes you have a bezdin of zabla. Mm-hmm. Zabla means is a acronym for zebor lo echad. That the way many court cases work is that one litigant picks his own dayan, and the other litigant picks his own dayan, and those two dayanim have to agree on a third. So that's happened with Rav Shechter a few times, that the Rav Shechter was the only dayan that the two dayanim picked by litigants could agree on. So each dayan went like his client, and then Rav Shechter had to decide the case. So that there was one time, apparently, there was a zabla, and Rav Moshe Feinstein was not the one that the two picked. He was picked by one of the clients, and one of the litigants, and then he was one of the three, and he and the other dayan picked the third. So then they came out with a decision, and explicitly show the vote in Besdin decisions as opposed to in the Supreme Court where every judge writes their own opinion. But so it came out from the language that was used in the decision that the decision was unanimous in favor of one of the parties, the all three dayanim. Mm-hmm. So the litigant came to Moshe Feinstein and said, what do you mean? I chose you as my dayan. You voted against me? Moshe Feinstein said, but you're wrong. I'm not obligated to vote for you. You picked me because you thought I was knowledgeable, whatever. But it's not like there's an obligation on the dayan that's chosen by each litigant to vote on behalf of their client. It's usually what happens, but not always. So Anshei Chayil. They're known that they don't give in to temptation And they even if they have desires for certain things, so they can control themselves. There should be nothing bad associated with them. So that, again, that they're also a good, well put together. So this is what you're supposed to do lechatchila. Again, this does not pasul bidyevid. If there was someone who was relatively knowledgeable and decided a case or served as dayan in some capacity, so bidyevid, it was found that he didn't necessarily have all these milas, and as long as he didn't have an explicit psul, violating explicit mitzvahs, for example, in an active way, then the judgments that bidyevid the dayan is still accepted. That's why they decided that famous case where we had a dayan who did not adhere to these criteria by any means in Washington D.C. If you remember this case where there were a lot of conversions performed by a rabbi who very much did not adhere to these principles, so. This was a whole tumult, but in the end, the senior Rabbanim in America came to the basically unanimous decision that all the conversions that this rabbi performed were going to be accepted. In the olden days, when the Jewish community was more cohesive and more under the control of the rabbis, so they used to put people in excommunication if they wouldn't listen, for example, or the whole community would shun them. Now we try to do as much as we can, but it's not as effective as it was in the olden days. And it can nowadays if you sign a binding arbitration agreement, so it can be enforced in secular court in general.